Welcome to The Gut Connection with Brian Jerby, MD, where we discuss the connection that gastrointestinal health has with all of health. We review the latest research and interview the greatest minds in this rapidly advancing field of gut health and integrative functional medicine. Please keep in mind that this podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be considered a substitute for care from a licensed medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that this does not constitute medical advice or other medical services. If you would like more information about Dr. Jerby and the type of medical care that he provides, please visit drjerby.com. That's drjerby.com. Now, let's get to this episode of The Gut Connection. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Gut Connection podcast. I'm Brian Jerby, your host, and today we are going to talk about bloating and distension. And I have to say that bloating and distension are some of the most common symptoms that I have in my practice, that folks are coming in and they're telling me they're bloated, they're distended, it's making their life miserable. And, you know, I'm sure that you at some point have experienced occasional symptoms of abdominal bloating or distension, and that may be related to eating a particular type of food or a particular meal. However, there are patients, a bunch of patients in my practice who, you know, have bloating as a chronic symptom, and it definitely over time, it has a significant negative impact on their quality of life. And perhaps you are one of these people as well, because studies show that the prevalence of bloating ranges somewhere between 16 and 31% in the general population, and as high as 66 to 90% in patients who have been labeled with irritable bowel syndrome or IBS. And just a little rabbit trail here. If you are my patient, you probably already heard this, but I want to tell you that I think irritable bowel syndrome is a bogus diagnosis. And here's the reason. Anytime doctors put syndrome on the end of a diagnosis, it means that they have no idea what causes it, and therefore it just becomes a label. So if you've been labeled as having IBS, then you get thrown into this big bucket, sometimes even like it's like a trash can. You get thrown into this big bucket of people that have this label of IBS. And that's just what it is, BS. Because most of the studies are now showing that IBS has a cause. And the reason that the cause hasn't been found in your case, if you have been labeled IBS, maybe because whoever you're working with hasn't looked far enough or hasn't dug deep enough to find the cause of IBS. So anyway, just to go back to our topic of bloating and distension, people that have been labeled IBS, about 66 to 90% of them have bloating and distension as part of their symptom complex. So when we talk about bloating and distension, then we have to lay down some definitions. And I don't want to get too technical, but, you know, it might be helpful to know what these things are so that you can tell if you've got them or not. So abdominal bloating is a subjective sensation. It may be gassiness, fullness, feeling a pressure, or maybe a sensation of being distended without obvious visible distension. And this can occur anywhere in the abdomen. I have patients telling me it's just in the lower abdomen. I have others telling me it's just in the upper abdomen. And every once in a while, I have one that says it's just right here in this specific area, like maybe the right upper quadrant or something like that. But so that's abdominal bloating. Abdominal distension is objective, meaning you can measure it. It's a physical manifestation that can be seen. And that's an actual increase in the abdominal girth, or, you know, you put a tape measure around your gut, in the morning, and then you repeat the measurement in the evening, and it's like 10 inches different. So that would be actual abdominal distension. And you know, if you have abdominal distension, you may be able to stand in front of a mirror sideways in the morning. And I have patients that send me pictures that show this. They stand in the mirror sideways in the morning and it looks pretty flat. And then they come home from work and do the same thing, stand sideways in the mirror, and lo and behold, their gut is extending outward. In fact, a lot of my patients say that when it's poking out like that, they look like they're 8 months pregnant, or they look like they got, you know, a huge balloon in their abdomen. And I've got scads of pictures in my electronic medical record that that demonstrate and document this visible distended abdomen. But just because you don't have a visible distended abdomen doesn't mean that you don't have a problem. The sensation of bloating is still can be an issue. So I don't want to minimize your symptoms. If you're not visibly distended, you could still have the sensation of bloating and have a problem going on, but it's not visibly pooching out there. Okay. So that's the definition. Where does this come from? Where does bloating and abdominal distension come from? Well, unfortunately, it could be from a number of different areas or a number of different factors in the same person. Okay. A lot of times there's not just one reason that a person is bloated or distended. But when a person is bloated or distended, the first thing you've got to do is make sure that it's not coming from something serious that's going to be a threat to your health. Okay. So, if a person has weight loss or rectal bleeding or anemia or black tarry stools or something bad like that, that needs to be investigated immediately. However, that's not the case with most people who have bloating. They don't have these so-called, what we call alarm symptoms, but instead they have one or more common etiologies for bloating. Okay, so I'll just give you a list here. Dietary intolerances, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, one of my favorite topics. Constipation, I know that sounds weird, but maybe another one of my favorite topics. Enteric nervous system, or the gut nervous system, is hypersensitive. And the final one is maybe one that you've never heard about, but it's real. It's called abdominophrenic dyssynergia. Now, that's a mouthful, and we're going to talk about it toward the end of the podcast. But, you know, those are kind of five of the main ones that I see that aren't, there are others that I see in my practice, such as exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, so a pancreas problem. Thyroid problem, yeah, that can cause bloating. Gastroparesis, meaning the stomach doesn't empty properly, that can cause bloating. Pelvic floor dysfunction, that's a problem. We're going to talk about that a little bit here on the podcast later. Celiac disease, or you know, a significant immune response to gluten, that's what celiac disease is. And then another thing that can cause bloating is something like previous GI surgery, like if you've had bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery, or a or reflux surgery, such as a Nissen fundoplication. So I don't want to use a whole bunch of big medical terms here, but if you've had a Nissen fundoplication for reflux, then you know what I'm talking about. So what we're really going to talk about today is these five kind of most common root causes that I encounter maybe every day in my practice. And if you have bloating, hopefully this will give you some tools to, you know, think about, you know, to try to assess maybe where your bloating might be coming from. And then, you know, hopefully that'll get you started down the right track or the right road to gaining some improvement in your discomfort. So that's the goal here. So let's talk about the very first one, diet. So it's possible that your bloating or distension might be coming from something in your diet. Now, usually, not always, but usually this is related to certain carbohydrates in the diet, which could be artificial sweeteners that have things like sugar alcohols, like sorbitol, glycerol, mannitol, things like that. These things can promote intestinal gas production and definitely can result in bloating. So you might start looking at some of the labels of your processed foods and make sure that there are not a bunch of artificial sweeteners in them. You know, these are things that you might eat or drink, such as diet sodas, for instance, chewing gum, coffee sweeteners, the list goes on and on. But there are also some good, healthy, natural foods that have sugar alcohols in them, such as apples. So there you go. The old adage of an apple a day keeps the doctor away is really not true. Because if you have a sorbitol sensitivity and you're eating apples, then that definitely could cause bloating and distension. I see a lot of people in my practice that have bloating secondary to carbohydrate intolerances and malabsorption of these carbohydrates. And, you know, there are tests that we can do for these problems, such as a lactose malabsorption test or fructose and other carbohydrates, for instance. However, if the truth be told, most of my patients who have carbohydrate intolerances and malabsorption actually end up having SIBO as the underlying cause, and we're going to talk about that next. However, there are a number of folks that I see that also have wheat intolerance and malabsorption that's not in the context of celiac disease. In other words, they've had the celiac disease test, that, you know, they're eating gluten, they've been tested, and they test negative, or maybe they've had the genetic test for celiac disease. And then they're having reactions to gluten. Well, we call that non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And studies show that about 70% of people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity report bloating as a symptom. We call it non-celiac gluten sensitivity, but it might not be the gluten that's causing the problem. It may be the carbohydrates that are in the gluten-containing products, you know, wheat, of course, being one of them, is wheat has fructans, F-R-U-C-T-A-N-S, if you want to look that up. It has fructans in it, and fructans is a type of oligosaccharide or a type of carbohydrate that some people could be sensitive to, and that might be the culprit of their bloating. Okay. So if you feel like diet might be the source of your bloating symptoms, then it would be safe to try a 2-week course of the low FODMAP diet, since studies have shown that people with abdominal symptoms, again labeled as IBS, I hate that, but they were labeled as IBS in this study, and they had a statistically significant improvement in bloating when they did a low FODMAP diet. So if you want to know more about low FODMAP diets. You know, you just search low FODMAP, FODMAP. That stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. But obviously, it's a lot easier to say low FODMAP. Okay. So you can look that up online and find just loads of, you know, of resources for a low FODMAP diet. There's a really great app that's put out by Monash University, MONASH. I think it's $8. I don't have any attachment to them other than I think it's a great app, but that can be very helpful, especially when you're in the grocery store to find out, hey, is this particular food low FODMAP or not? So anyway, there's lots of tools out there, and those could help you for that two-week course. But I want to kind of give you a heads up that the low FODMAP diet is not really a very good, quote-unquote, forever diet, okay? Since it is possible that it could lead to some nutritional deficiencies, it's fairly restrictive and could even lead to increased intolerances of other foods. So I think it's good to use it for a relatively short period of time. You should see some improvement in 2 weeks. So if the low FODMAP diet works, you're thinking, wow, you know, my symptoms, my bloating's better over these past 2 weeks. Then we have to ask the question, why? Why does it work? Well, the big question then is, could it be that you have SIBO? Now, SIBO stands for, that's S-I-B-O, and it stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So that's what we want to talk about next as a source of bloating, SIBO. SIBO is characterized more or less by the presence of excess bacteria in the small intestine, where these guys should not be setting up housekeeping. Okay, the small intestine should have relatively few bacteria in it, you know, tens of thousands per milliliter versus, you know, millions and billions per milliliter in the colon or the large intestine. So relatively few compared to the large intestine. But if these get overgrown for whatever reason, if these bacteria get overgrown in the small intestine where they shouldn't be, then it leads to fermentation that really should only happen in the large intestine. And fermentation, as you probably know, produces certain gases. And these gases can lead to abdominal distension and bloating, as well as other symptoms like abdominal pain, reflux, diarrhea or constipation, and, you know, even symptoms outside of the gut. Okay. And this SIBO is a very common reason for bloating, in my experience at least. And if you have bloating and you've had a bunch of tests, they're all negative, you had an endoscopy, you've had a colonoscopy, you've had a CT scan, and you're still looking for the reason for bloating, then it just might be SIBO. And the way that we diagnose SIBO is through a glucose or lactulose breath test. I use lactulose as a rule, since this is my opinion looking at the studies, and I've come to this conclusion that it gives us a better idea, especially of methane, in my experience, because we want to address as many gases as we can. But, you know, if you've had a glucose breath test, it also is acceptable. So anyway, a breath test is what we do because we're testing for overproduction of hydrogen, of methane, and more and more opportunities to test for overproduction of hydrogen sulfide as well. So that's how we diagnose this. And if you are diagnosed with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, then you will likely need some type of antimicrobial therapy to knock this down. Okay, and this could include pharmaceuticals such as rifaximin and others, herbals such as berberine and others, or maybe even a nutritional treatment such as the elemental diet. I use all of these in my practice for the treatment of SIBO and have had success with each one of them. And, you know, most times I try to match the treatment with the unique characteristics of each individual person that I see and their unique symptoms. There are no two people that are the same, and therefore there is no one-size-fits-all treatment. So maybe you've been diagnosed with SIBO and your doctor keeps just repeatedly treating you with rifaximin, for instance. In my experience, it's good to switch it up if you've had to do multiple treatments. And I tell my patients it's kind of like boxing. You know, you could do all right jabs, but a right jab followed by a left hook is probably going to be a better way to really knock your opponent out. And that's what we're trying to do, is knock out the bacterial overgrowth. And I think that's a great way to look at it. We need to have different strategies if a person's, you know, responding partially. We need to come back and see if there's any other treatment that might be more effective for you. So when it comes to SIBO, I'm shooting for about 80 to 85% improvement in symptoms. And if we're making progress but aren't quite there yet, then we just keep going. Don't give up. Keep going. And sometimes we have to repeat the breath test. Don't be surprised if that's necessary, just to see where we are and what tells us what to do next. So you might might need the old 1-2 punch, a right jab followed by a left hook, and that might just finish it off. So, and sometimes the elemental diet is the only thing that works, but many times the antimicrobial treatments are effective. So just remember, the point is, yes, I have a point. So there is no one-size-fits-all treatment. And remember that the treatment that is effective for you might not be effective for the next person. And the treatment that was effective for that person given a testimonial on the internet might not work for you. So, you know, just remember that. That's really important. And the other thing that we have to remember in SIBO is that we have to try to address the underlying cause if it can be identified. And in many cases, the underlying cause is, you know, a number of different factors that have added up over time and then resulted in the gradual evolution of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I don't want to get into all those that could be weighing in on that, but you know, in some cases, the point is that it might be multifactorial, but in other cases, we are able to identify the underlying cause, such as previous food poisoning, for instance. You know, I ask my patients to assess what might have caused their SIBO, and I do that by giving them a handout where they can give, you know, they can rank the severity of their symptoms and then answer questions concerning other factors that can be playing into the development of SIBO, including, things like prior abdominal surgery or pelvic inflammatory disease or autoimmune disease or traumatic brain injury or thyroid problems. Yes, thyroid problems can cause SIBO. Diabetes can cause SIBO. Epstein-Barr can cause it. Lyme disease. Mold toxicity is something I see quite a bit of. And even genetic diseases, you know, such as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or EDS. And that's a that's a small list, okay? But the point is that it's important to try to identify an underlying cause because it could impact the treatment or the length of treatment that's necessary. And sometimes the underlying cause can be addressed and corrected so that a person's SIBO can be cured just by doing that. So, enough about SIBO. Okay, we talk about this a lot, and the reason I talk about it a lot because there's a lot of people out there with it, and that's probably one of the main things that I see in my practice. SIBO, SIBO, SIBO. The second most common thing that I see in my practice is constipation. Chronic constipation. Not just, you know, every once in a while, but all the time. And chronic constipation has been estimated to affect around 15%. That's a lot of people. 15% of the adult population. And bloating is a bothersome symptom for many folks that have chronic constipation. So I don't want to take too much time on constipation since I did a whole podcast on it. So go back and, you know, listen to that podcast. But just a reminder that when you are evaluated for chronic constipation, then three big picture areas need to be addressed. Number one, colonic motility or overall gut motility, meaning how long does it take for, you know, the food to be digested, move through your small intestine, and then the waste material move around the large intestine and finally be, you know, evacuated. Okay, so impairment in transit or motility, like it's kind of slow getting around the path. That's one thing that needs to be looked at. A second thing that needs to be looked at is pelvic floor dysfunction, meaning, okay, things go down the trail pretty efficiently, but when they get down to the rectum, then the person has a hard time evacuating or getting the stool out. So there's lots of straining and struggling to actually pass a bowel movement. Doesn't have any trouble getting down there, but the person has trouble getting it out. So that's called pelvic floor dysfunction. That needs to be evaluated. And then this, not really evaluation, but the third thing to consider is that the worst of constipation would be a combination of both slowed down motility or transit and pelvic floor dysfunction. So the stool moves around the GI tract very slowly, and when it finally gets down to the rectum, the person has trouble getting it out, has trouble evacuating. So that's a combined problem. And that's the worst kind of combination. So if you're bloated and have constipation, then you will need to be evaluated for colonic or large intestinal motility, as well as pelvic floor problems. You can get a good idea of whether or not you have a pelvic floor problem. Don't get me wrong. This is not fail-safe, but you can get an idea by assessing the amount of straining that you have to do to have a bowel movement. If you have a daily bowel movement but have to strain or change positions or support your pelvic floor or any of those things, then you may well have a pelvic floor problem. And, you know, this needs to be evaluated objectively. And the way we do that is with what's called anorectal manometry. On the other hand, if you're skipping days between bowel movements, but you don't have to strain to, you know, evacuate the bowel movement, then you may well have a motility problem. The colon just doesn't move it through fast enough. However, if you're skipping days and straining a lot to pass the bowel movement, then it's very possible that you have both. Okay, so suffice it to say that this needs to be objectively evaluated by a licensed practitioner who knows what he or she is doing and has a lot of experience in this area. A lot of my patients have slow transit, or in other words, decreased motility, whatever term you want to use. And this may be related, if that's what you got, it may be related to overproduction of methane gas anywhere in the GI tract. So you can tell if you have overproduction of methane from a breath test. So you also might get an idea, it's not definitive, but you might get an idea of whether or not methane could be a problem on a stool test that, you know, evaluates the numbers of methane producing bacteria in your stool. So that's not definitive, but that could give you an idea. And then you would do a definitive test, which would be the breath test. So if you have an overgrowth of methane producing bacteria, they're not really bacteria, but that's what I'm going to call them. And methane is slowing down your bowels, then we call that intestinal methanogen overgrowth, or EMO, IMO. Again, this needs to be treated with antimicrobials, and in my experience, sometimes small intestinal fungal overgrowth is a coinciding problem. Did another whole podcast on that topic if you want to hear more about that, but suffice it to say that small intestinal fungal overgrowth, or SIFO, and EMO can coincide, and the problem can be even worse because of the two of them working together, or whatever they do. We don't really know if they kind of support each other, or they're just doing their own thing, and each of them have negative effects on the gut. We don't know. Maybe they work in concert together. So that's constipation. Now let's talk about some things that maybe you don't know as much about, or maybe haven't even heard about, as possibilities in bloating. Well, one of them is something that we call enteric nervous system hypersensitivity. Now, the enteric nervous system is the nervous system of the gut, okay? So that's why we call it enteric. That means gut. Enteric nervous system, we call that kind of the second brain because it's really extensive, and I could give you a bunch of data and details about the extensiveness of the enteric nervous system. But suffice it to say that, like the central nervous system, the enteric nervous system can be hypersensitive or can get annoyed or irritated. But this is more difficult to evaluate objectively. Enteric nervous system hypersensitivity or hyperreactivity doesn't have a specific test to, you know, determine if that is the etiology of your bloating. However, this overreactivity of the gut nervous system has been implicated as a mechanism by which, you know, symptoms of bloating may occur in people that have been labeled with IBS. And I make that point again, labeled. All right, I don't like IBS, but that's what they've done the studies for. People labeled with IBS and hypersensitivity of the enteric nervous system may be an issue. In light of this, you know, conventional medicine has a number of different medications that have been used and shown to be helpful in improving bloating, and these are medications such as antidepressants, and they've studied both tricyclic antidepressants, which are the older version, and then the newer version are like SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors is what that stands for. Other things like gabapentin and pregabalin, and, you know, just a number of different medications. And unfortunately, these are symptom treatments. It doesn't really address the underlying reason that the gut is so hypersensitive. And to be quite honest, nobody really knows why. In light of that, though, that there are another a number of non-medical therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, gut-directed hypnotherapy, and others that have been shown to be effective in the treatment of, you know, GI disorders that have been labeled as IBS, in which, you know, bloating is a very common symptom. So those were people that got the label of IBS. They also had bloating and these medications and non-medical therapies were shown to be successful or at least helpful, not successful, helpful. It's not completely understood, obviously, but it's some dysfunction of the gut-brain connection. And I think that it has something to do with the vagus nerve. And fortunately, there's lots of vagus nerve research that's being done. So hopefully we're going to have some additional answers in this area in the days to come. And I get most, if not all, of my patients on vagus nerve treatments if they have bloating, SIBO, other, you know, and all these other GI problems. So that's that. Enteric nervous hypersensitivity as a reason for bloating. And then finally, one that is less well known, but you need to know about, is something called abdominophrenic dyssynergia. That's a mouthful. It's a less well-known reason for bloating, and studies suggest that it may be more prevalent than originally thought as far as a cause for bloating. So how does this happen? Well, this occurs when you develop a paradoxical response to the distension or something distending the intestine. Like, for instance, you eat a meal, and normally when you put something in your gut, what happens is that the diaphragm relaxes and goes kind of higher up into your chest, and the abdominal wall tightens somewhat. Now, this is not something you do consciously. It's unconscious, but it's kind of like a reflex. And that your diaphragm goes higher into your chest and your tummy tightens, and that allows accommodation of the increased volume in the gut without allowing the abdomen to protrude outward. Okay. This is, again, this is not voluntary. It just happens reflexively. However, stuff happens, and that unconscious reflexive sort of thing can get messed up, and the opposite can occur. So it's paradoxical. In other words, you put something in your gut and the abdominal wall muscles relax and the diaphragm contracts. And when the diaphragm contracts, it goes down toward the abdomen more and pushes your abdominal contents downward. And since your abdominal wall muscles relax, then your tummy pooches out. It distends your abdomen. And, this is called abdominophrenic dyssynergia, because abdomino meaning the abdominal wall muscles, phrenic meaning the diaphragm, dyssynergia meaning paradoxical activity. And unfortunately, there's no test that's currently available to, you know, easily assess for this problem, but biofeedback therapy has been shown to be effective for this. And again, that sort of biofeedback therapy that's necessary for this is not widely available, so it's probably not an option in your case. However, I've had a significant amount of success with having my patients do diaphragmatic breathing and strengthening exercises. And I have a protocol for this, and this seems to be effective in many cases. So remember that abdominophrenic dyssynergia may be a component of someone's bloating, but not necessarily the only thing. So in other words, this could be going on as part of the problem, but there also could be, you know, like SIBO, or there could be, you know, food intolerances or whatever. These are additive sorts of things. and you know, it can get rather complicated to figure all this out. So I would suggest again that if you're having lots of bloating and you're struggling to figure out why and what's causing it and all those kind of things, please undergo evaluation by a licensed practitioner who is very experienced in these areas. That's where you're going to have the greatest chance for significant improvement. And, you know, another thing to remember is his or her practice needs to be able to tell you about their comprehensive approach where all of these aspects can be evaluated. Okay, so they need to be able to do breath tests, stool tests, anorectal manometry, balloon expulsion, carbohydrate intolerance evaluation, and, you know, the list goes on and on. So if you're struggling with bloating, just to kind of bring this home, I hope this has been a helpful overview for you. It's a very common symptom, and many, if not most, of my patients struggle with it. And a lot of my patients have undergone a bunch of tests without any answers, and maybe so have you. So, you know, you might, through all of this, realize that you need someone experienced in this area, then, you know, please reach out. If you feel like our clinic might be a good fit for you, reach out to us. We have experience in a good comprehensive approach that most people need for bloating and the complexities of it. And if you feel like we're a good fit, it's what you're looking for, then you can look us up online. Look at the show notes. Our website's there. Give us a call directly. You know, see what we offer is what you need, what you're looking for. We're here to help. So I'm going to bring this home and call it good for another Gut Connection podcast. Thanks for joining us. And if you're enjoying these podcasts, please give us a nice review, thumbs up, or whatever it is on your podcast player. And tell others that you might know who might benefit from what we talk about on the Gut Connection. So see y'all again in the very, very near future. God bless you all. Goodbye. And that ends this episode of the Gut Connection. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll look forward to having you back for our next episode, where we'll discuss more gut-related topics and interview leaders in this rapidly advancing field. If you would like more information, please visit us at drjerby.com. That's drjerby.com. Until next time, take care and may God bless you.